Welcome to The Weekly on WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I'm Jamie Yu, and with me is Owen Anderson, and we are the co-news directors for WOBC this academic year. We hope you're all doing well. For today's show, we have a senior staff writer from the Oberlin Review, Walter Thomas Patterson. We're excited to talk to Walter about his off-the-cuff interview with Rabbi Megan Dougherty, the director of Hillel and Jewish Campus Life. Walter, thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, thank you for having me. And my name is Walter, and I'm a dual degree first year. I study piano, performance in the conservatory, and probably politics in the college. And I kind of got into the review during my first semester, and it was a really new experience for me. I had never done any journalism beforehand, but it was just the articles I was working on, they were just fascinating, and I loved interviewing people. And kind of now, my second semester, now that I'm fortunate enough to be a staff writer, I've had the opportunity to write off-the-cuff interviews. I've been able to dive into issues a little bit deeper with guests. And my interview with Rabbi Dougherty is a perfect example of that. And we were really able to take an idea. The issue of abortion is, you know, it's a controversial issue, and I was really able to explore a perspective that I had never really thought about, and it was really eye opening for me.
I guess what was the impetus for this article? What made you want to take it on?
Yeah, so Rabbi Dougherty had written an opinion article for the newspaper Cleveland.com, and in that article she gave a Judaic religious argument for why abortion should be legal. So within the Torah we have this this section known as a Mishaptim, and it's read on this yearly cycle, and this is what she bases her argument for why abortion should be, why it's legal, and why the life of the mother takes precedence over the life of the fetus. And she paraphrases here, but basically she says there's this situation that says when men fight and one of them winds up pushing or shoving a woman who is pregnant and she is physically fine, but there's a miscarriage, then the one who pushes her will surely be punished or fined according to the payment of her husband demands. But then we have this line saying that if she is physically hurt, then the penalty will be a life for a life, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, which in Jewish law, the rabbis understood to be financial compensation. No one was actually ever plucking people's eyes, right? So the distinction here, and this is something she says, right, is that the fetus is separated out, it's different, right? And in context, it's coming in these series of laws explaining what happens when someone commits murder, right, manslaughter. And then when we're reading all of this, it becomes clear in context that, you know, in a miscarriage, right, the death of the fetus is not equal to the life of a living person. And that's kind of where she bases her entire argument for why abortion should be legal.
So did you see Rabbi Megan's article?
Yes. And I was fortunate enough to be my news editors at the Review let me know about it. And they were like, there's this great article written by Rabbi Dougherty, who I should also add is the Hillel director here at Oberlin. And so I read the article, and then I reached out to Rabbi Dougherty from there.
Mm-hmm. And were you familiar with the Heartbeat Bill before interviewing her? And what was it like to read her article? How did you feel about it?
Yeah, so like I'd always, kind of like in high school, I tried to follow politics as best I could. And I had like always heard about like heartbeat bills kind of more generally as like that was something that conservative states were doing. But this was the first time reading her article that she really kind of dove into the issue. I just found it fascinating because I never really thought about how there was this religious argument for abortion and how that fits into the larger argument around, I guess, how, I guess, and something that she says in the my interview, right, is that abortion has been the religious argument against abortion almost completely a Christian one, right? And then she is saying, no, look at this. There's a Jewish argument for why abortion should be legal. And that's just really fascinating because that never – there are not that many articles written about why this vibrant Jewish argument for why abortion should be legal. And I think that's really important that enters the conversation.
And since this was an OTC with a religious leader, how did you prepare for the off-the-cuff and decide what questions you wanted to ask?
That's a really good question because I was a little worried when I was starting this because I was not very familiar with Judaism and there was a lot I feel like I had to learn. But what was really fascinating is that I was exploring, learning about Rabbi Doherty's background, and then she has this background in Reconstructionist Judaism, which if you understand that there are these different there are these different streams of Judaism, and Reconstructionist is probably the most liberal. And one of the kind of the like important phrases that kind of governs how they their Judaic perspective is the past has a vote, but not a veto. And basically, the whole idea there is that they're really looking at these historical texts from the Torah, right, which they read on these weekly cycles, and then they're saying, okay, how can we apply that to the life that we live today in this modern world, right, where there are two incredibly different environments that we're coming from, right? One of this ancient Near East, right? And then we're living in this modern, this globalized world. And then we're saying, okay, we'll take the past into account, but we'll also use the present as a way of really, we'll kind of meld those two together, as opposed to more traditionalist views, I should say, like, if you're an Orthodox Jew, it would be much more based on the past. It kind of does have the veto.
So OTCs are like, in the article, it's a transcribed interview. How did you go about asking questions that would both inform the reader and give Rabbi Doherty space to talk in the conversation?
That's really interesting. So I kind of wanted to start, I think, the way I went about this was I started off kind of asking about her background because I think that was really important and kind of just for readers at least is to kind of just first understand her perspective. And that was really interesting because she talked about how she studied at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in Philadelphia. And she talked about what that had meant for her. And then she talked about the previous job she had had teaching. She was at a position at the Yale, and I'm forgetting. I think it was within a Jewish community at Yale, but I don't remember the exact position.
The Center for Jewish Life at Yale University.
Thank you. The Center for Jewish Life at Yale University. And she'd had these positions, right? And then kind of moving forward, right? This kind of, for me at least, that kind of informed me about kind of her more general perspective. And then we kind of dove into the issue more specifically. And one of the things I really wanted to do when I asked her about this, opposed to just saying, okay, what is your opinion? I wanted her to actually read the text because the text is so powerful and present in just her argument. And especially I think within Judaism, there's like this commitment to reading, to reading these cycles, right? And I wanted her, so she actually got the text there and we were reading it, right? She was kind of paraphrasing because it's this ancient text. And she was saying, well, look at this here. And then she was kind of explaining how she went about interpreting the text. And then we used that, right, she kind of connected that to then show how this informed her argument, I guess. And I guess I wanted to kind of show that process for listeners or for readers, right, of how she went about making this, kind of constructing her argument, I guess. And that was good for me at least too, because I felt like I was kind of this outsider when it came to understanding this religious text.
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating to learn that Rabbi Doherty even took out the text and kind of worked through it with you.
Yeah, and it was definitely something where she was working through it just like, even though she was really familiar with it. She was like still really having to think about it because it's complex stuff, right? It's Mishaptim, which literally means law. So she's reading through all these laws that are governing how people, you know, behaved with one another.
So, I mean, with the review, there's only so much space for your article. So were there parts of your conversation that didn't make it into the article, but you still want to mention, or parts that just resonated with you in general?
The most important thing that it was touched on briefly in the OTC, but I was hoping to expand on a little bit here, is talking about how within American politics today, we have a religious right that is very, I would say, consolidated in terms of being, they have a lot of visibility, right, within Congress, within the Senate and the House, right? And how that religious right kind of directs the conversation around abortion, directs the debate around abortion, and kind of these social issues, right? And Rabbi Doherty was basically, one of the points she was making was that there needs to be a strong religious left in order to have a healthy democracy, because just as much as you can make a religious argument for political issues on the right, you can make an argument for them on the left as well. And she kind of brought in, talked about issues like immigration, for example, immigration issues where there's a really strong argument on the left for why, for having a more liberal immigration policy, right? And oftentimes these issues kind of get framed in a way that leaves that perspective out. And I think the other thing, which is also just fascinating as well, is when you think about what it means, what family values mean. We talk about, issues like abortion and just reproductive justice in general, because oftentimes when we talk about abortion, it's always like just abortion, but we have to remember that this is an issue of, you know, the provider of abortion, which is Planned Parenthood, right? They do so much more than just, right? I should say, abortion is coupled with so many other services that really support this idea of the family, right? But that's an idea that's been it's so intertwined with being, if you support family values, then somehow you're only on the right. And that's really bad, because I think it's just so misleading. What it means to support the family, right? To support the power of women to decide, you know, what they want to do with their bodies.
And was there anything else from your conversation with Rabbi Doherty that didn't make it into the article, but that you'd like to share here?
I would say one more thing, and I might think of something else, but she kind of brought attention to the National Council of Jewish Women, which were this advocacy organization that campaigned for women's issues and also abortion rights. And that was something for her, at least, that really, it really reflected the vibrancy of the reproductive justice movement within the Jewish community, because she kind of outlined how it wasn't just Reconstructionist Jews who were part of this movement, right? It was all these different streams, right? So I think sometimes maybe from the interview it might have been like, oh, well, Reconstructionist Jews are the only ones who are, you know, who are really passionate about abortion rights. But what she kind of showed was that, no, Reconstructionist Jews may have, there may be differences, right? Because, you know, abortion is all about drawing the line at a certain point. But overall, within the Jewish community, there is this really big commitment to abortion rights. And that's reflected in all these different streams of Jews being a part of the National Council of Jewish Women.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was... There might be something else, but I'm looking at my notes here. I think that was like the main thing, just to kind of, for me at least.
Yeah, that's totally fine.
I think we're gonna pivot here to your experience at the review. So more broadly, how has that been during the pandemic, especially as a first year?
You know, it's been really good. And I wrote an article about kind of my experiences the first year a little bit too, and that was kind of good for me, because one of the things that I've thought about a lot is what does it mean to like have a first year experience where you can't really determine whether you don't know what normal feels like because you've never been in college before. So I'm kind of just, I'm trying to like take everything in, but then at the same time, not take everything too seriously because I know this year is so unprecedented. And I just have to be able to just kind of, a lot of it's just being really kind to myself and just like understand that like there's going to be these weird experiences, and it's hard to, I can't really say whether it's because of the, you know, this pandemic, or is it because, am I going through a change? Like, am I like discovering myself more deeply, or is it my classes, right? All these different things. Like what am I using to inform, to learn more about myself? Cause sometimes it's confusing, right? With all these different, you have like the pandemic, and then you have these new classes you're taking, new people you're meeting. But the review was a really good way of like focusing all that kind of uncertainty, all that energy, right, I have, and like making it into this really constructive thing where I was like learning more about the community and just like challenging myself, right? And then making it into something that's like really physical that I can like put out into the world and people can read, as opposed to just having it all kind of in your brain. Because that's what can happen when you're in this new experience, right, of college. It's like you get kind of stressed and you get unsure because like, wait, I'm having all these new experiences, right? And there are all these things that I'm trying to do, right? And then like with the review, it was like, it was this really concrete way of kind of processing that and just kind of like focusing your brain on something that's like outside of your classes. And it was just really, I'm so grateful because the people at the review, my news editors, were so just kind with their time and just like helping me out with this. And it was really good because the first couple articles I wrote it was difficult for me. Like I spent a long time trying to get them like how I wanted them to be. But then like as time goes on, it's like I can tell that I'm really getting more just comfortable with the process, and that's making it just, I can focus on, I have more time to just really kind of get outside my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate your point about the ability to kind of explore the wider campus community, because I also started writing for the review in my first semester of college. And at the time I was so wrapped up in, you know, my classes and, you know, how to take notes, how to go to office hours, how to ask questions. And writing for the review really got me out of my comfort zone as well, where I like talked to people from clubs I never really thought about, or I met people that I never would have otherwise. So I definitely appreciate it for those reasons, even still today. And we actually just had Ella on last week. She was great. Yeah, we talked to her about her latest article on K-12 vaccinations.
Yeah, she's great work. I love working with Ella. So it's been really good because she's my news editor, right? She's like challenging me, but it's really good. I'm just like learning so much from them, from her and Gigi. So
Walter, you're already a senior staff writer in your second semester, and you've written for mostly news and ops. And before our conversation began, you mentioned the journalism bug. So I was wondering if you wanted to expand on that a little bit.
It's a good question. I would say, I'll start off by saying that I'm a dual degree student, so I'm kind of like living part of my life in music and part of my life in like academics. And I've also written for the art section as well. And I guess I just find the review is like a perfect way of like kind of fully absorbing both worlds in a way of like my academic part of my kind of brain and more musical. And I've always just been someone who's very passionate about contemporary politics and really understanding not just politics, but just understanding the community and the world we live in today. And I find the review, and I'll start with I see the news section and the art section as a really good way of just beginning to make sense of this like kind of new community that I moved to, right? As opposed to, like, cause I come from Southern Illinois, and it's kind of similar to where I am now, but I love being able to just begin to understand, right, this community that I'm living in now in Oberlin. And in some ways, I've kind of, my articles are kind of a little bit all over the place in terms of, I'm just kind of like finding something interesting and latching onto it and exploring that issue, right? I wrote an article about like a Biden campaign office and then how a burrito shop was opening and, you know, just all these different things, right? But I think what, I don't know, maybe like what unifies them is this, I'm just a really just naturally curious person. And I find that language and that interviewing and that talking is a way of just making sense of everything that I'm taking in, right? And I love working with language and words and understanding people's like beliefs. And just the review is like such a perfect way to do that.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think OBs are very naturally curious people. We like to really ask deep questions and get to the heart of an issue. And now we have a journalism concentration here, which has really kind of met the demand of a lot of students who really want to explore this further. But for now, like, the campus publications are a really great way to kind of get that on-the-ground experience, I'd say.
Yeah. And I was just really struck by how kind of just open people are to, like, if I have an idea, I'll just send it to the arts editor or the news editor, and then, like, I'll kind of explain what I want to do, and they're like, that's a great idea. You should pursue that, right? So they're so open to just, like, anything that is like of like relevant value. It's just like, they'll be like, yeah, explore that. And that kind of intellectual openness is really, it makes writing just fun because you can write about, you know, can write about what you're passionate, right? What really motivates you, you can write about that. And that just given me like this kind of sense of like urgency in a way, because I know like, I'm not going to be here at Oberlin forever, right? But I also know that like, I have all these opportunities. So it's really just giving me like, in a way, it's like kind of motivating me. And it just kind of reminding me of like what like meaningful work is, right? And that's just a really good, especially when you have, and everything is so virtual and just intangible, kind of like everything is removed, kind of. It's really important to have something that's like really physical. It's like, I can do this. I can put this out.
Yeah, exactly. So do you have any, I know like the pitch system at the review can kind of maybe restrict your ideas a little bit, but do you have anything that you want to cover in the future for the review?
I would say one thing I really want to do is do more of these kind of off the cuff or even on the record interviews where I'm talking to kind of probably faculty members especially, and just really exploring just the wealth of knowledge they have on really pretty much anything, I think. I think it's so important that we listen to just, like, experts and even just people who have all this experience and this perspective, right, that's informed by this research and all this just thought they put into their, you know, into their fields, right? And I think being able to bring that out and bring that out and kind of share that with people can just really, it just really helps stimulate conversation and just, it's really healthy when people are talking about, and discussing important issues. And I find that, especially with this, the interview I did, I also interviewed my piano teacher too. And just, there's so much out there that needs to just be brought up and talked about. And I find that these interviews, right, are a perfect way to do that.
Yeah, great. Before we end, is there anything else you want to add, Walter, about your article, the review, things in general?
I don't know if I have anything off the top of my head, but I guess it's made me realize, I guess, especially with the review and even just being at college here, that there's so much I have to learn. And I just really, how I've really been able to see how I can like grow both personally and just academically here. But then it's also like, I see how much yet I still have to learn. So it's been really cool to see the growth happen, but also then realize everything that I still want to learn. And that kind of process is really cool to kind of to be able to witness, I think.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great mindset to carry with you. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. We really love talking to you about the OTC and just learning so much about what Rabbi Doherty had to say.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking with us, Walter.
We would now like to air Walter Thomas Patterson's interview with Rabbi Megan Doherty, the director of Hillel and Jewish Campus Life. A print version of Walter's off-the-cuff article was published in the Oberlin Review's news section on February 24th, 2021.
So the first question I kind of wanted to ask, and I was kind of thinking about this, I was reading your biography and also like where you had previously like worked and everything, is kind of like, what's your kind of background within the Jewish community? And how does that kind of like influence your perspective on Judaism? And also as a Jewish person yourself, how has your lived experience kind of influenced your beliefs?
So I grew up in a sort of loose, in a Reform Jewish family, more or less. There's a longer story, but not relevant here. And really came to my own sense of Jewish practice and identity and sort of in college. I had friends and we'd have Shabbat and we'd sort of do all these Jewish things together. And I really was learning about lots of kinds of Jewish practice for the first time and engaging in myself and really finding valuable and meaningful and kind of wanting. And I was at a really progressive place a lot like Oberlin. So it wasn't like there was any sort of, being Jewish was part of that mostly. Although I think of lots of pieces of Judaism are countercultural to a lot of, kind of general mainstream American culture. And so that, that was also present. And I grew up in the Northwest. I grew up in Seattle, right? My parents are, lefty liberal baby boomers. Yeah. That's who they are. And so that's how I grew up. And like, it was pretty, wound up in rabbinical school in Philadelphia. I went to the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, which is, a place of, there's a lot of really serious and rigorous engagement with sort of text and tradition and like, what is this, what all these pieces of Judaism we're inheriting? And also like Reconstructionism also has this really serious commitment to the notion of Judaism as an evolving civilization, evolving religious civilization. So, one of the famous aphorisms is the past has a vote, but not a veto. And which means that you take the past really seriously, right? You have to give the past its voice and its vote and really, and like not even the past, but like, how are these traditions and practices and ideas like relevant in our own lives? And then we sort of say, okay, and we live in at least two civilizations, probably more these days. And how do we exist within them both in ways that are authentic and kind of intellectually and morally honest and let us sort of be in both those places? Yeah.
And then I was also really interested to know kind of your previous jobs. I understand that, I want to make sure I'm getting this right because I don't want to like mispronounce it, but you worked with the, you had a, sorry, I just want to make sure I'm getting this right. It says, the Mishkan, is it Ha'am Reconstructionist Community. And then you were also a senior Jewish fellow and I think associate rabbi at Yale. And I'm wondering what kind did that influence you in terms of your, how else did that influence your, did it at all?
Oh, I'm like, that's a great, so those were both, working at the Hillel at Yale, one of the best things it did for me, was that the Jewish community at Yale is, really diverse, is a Jewishly very diverse place. It is a community such that like no one kind of branch or movement within Judaism really dominates. And so there's a sense of like everyone is in one Jewish community together from a bunch of different places. And so for me, that was an amazing opportunity to have really deep and meaningful relationships with and learn from and with students who were from Reform and conservative and Orthodox and, not anything, just Jewish communities, and really sort of figuring out how to be a rabbi and how to serve Jews with lots of different perspectives and takes on practice and takes on Jewish law or even theology that were different than mine, and we were still in relationship in this project of doing Jewish together.
Yeah.
So that was a really valuable thing I learned from there, and I mm-hmm. still have, you know, in touch with those students, yeah. and some of those students, and you know, they're doing amazing things out in the world yeah. in really different Jewish ways. And Mishkanah was it was a denominational community, right? It's an affiliated Reconstructionist mm-hmm. Community, Reconstructionist Jewish community, and they're super sweet and super creative and really fun. And I realized when I was there a little bit that I missed the like diversity and the kind of energy that comes when you have Jews coming from different places asking different questions together. Yeah. And I really missed that. So it was really exciting for me, you know, so, and Oberlin has a different like range of Jewish diversity than Yale did, but it also has one, and that's really fun.
Wow. Okay. So, and there's a lot I can dive into. I'm really excited about, but at Oberlin specifically, I understand you're the director of the Hillel community. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then could you talk briefly about what kinds of things you're doing with that community? I know what exact role do you play in terms of as director?
That's a great question. And we are, you know, and it's ever evolving. That is an ever evolving answer.
Yeah.
So there is a chartered student org, which is Hillel. And so I sort of am there. I'm not their official advisor for complicated bureaucratic reasons, but I'm their like unofficial, like, advisor helper. That's sort of one piece, and sort of helping, you know, we sort of work together figuring out some kinds of programming and some kind, you know, and things around holidays or speakers, stuff like that. This semester and last semester, I'm doing a lot of teaching. So we run two different Jewish learning fellowships, which are they're each a 10-week commitment, so an hour a week for 10 weeks, doing a deep dive into different Jewish texts and questions and how do they impact your life. So one of them is this semester we're offering Life's Big Questions for fourth years. So you're on your way out, you're on your way to graduating college. Let's really sit down and look at some of these like fundamental questions of how we live our lives. And in conversation with, you know, classic Jewish texts and YouTube and TikTok videos and poetry, whatever, like all the different pieces in this, and our own stories and how do we, you know, how do we ask better questions? How do we learn things? And then the other class we're teaching is Sex, Love, and Romance. Wow. Same model, what are the like deep and important questions around sex, love, and romance? So.
I see. And then I would really be interested to dive a little bit deeper into Reconstructionist Judaism. And I was also wondering, because as I was kind of researching the article you're writing and also your background, how does that I would call it a stream of Judaism? How does that
stream or movement? Good.
Yeah, movement. How does that? Are its views on abortion the same as the other streams of Judaism? Because because my understanding is very quickly here. My understanding is that across the board, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's generally Jews across the spectrum tend to be pro-choice, but my understanding is that there's varying degrees, I guess.
So it's a really good question, and so I'm actually going to answer that one because I could spend like an hour talking about what Reconstructionist Judaism is, and it would or would not answer a question. Answer the question, but so around abortion, and I think one of the things I was really trying to lift up in the op-ed is that, you know, that there are different, like in contemporary Jewish life, there are people who have different, practices or different understandings of abortion, right? Yeah. There's different, you know, people who have different limits, or we'll say, you know, but that fundamentally for pretty much all Jews, and I think there are probably exceptions because Judaism is, you know, multifaceted, multivocal, and two Jews, three opinions is not actually an overstatement of the, but I think the sort of things I laid out in the op-ed, and then there's more, and some of these really fundamental, you know, both that piece from the Torah that I, you know, which says for Leviticus is like this critical, but that idea of kind of prior, you know, who's, the relative value of a fetus in the womb versus the relative value of like a living human yes. being, and how we sort of adjudicate harm to each one, yeah. which is a very like Jewish way of thinking about like how we, that's how we sort of we figure out sort of values out of sometimes like legal conversations.
Yeah.
So it's this really this clear example of we have this example we have we could say well clearly here the value of like this damage to this you know the, of this miscarriage doesn't actually look like the way the Torah adjudicates murder and manslaughter. So clearly from this really core foundational piece of Judaism for everybody, like this is a core foundational piece for everyone, this is the text from which sort of almost all Jewish law about abortion comes, there is this really clear distinction of, there's this clear difference. And so pretty much almost everything else is attempt to figure out, well, what does that mean? What are the limits of that? And what, you know, how do we understand that? But that, and I think so, and that framework
yeah.
is a very different framework than, kind of the mainstream American one, which is a pretty Christian one, yeah. if not an explicitly Catholic one, okay. around sort of life beginning at conception, or right? like that just, that's not yeah. a, and like that, and that life having, you know, the same value as life of someone who is, you know, like a person who has been born. So
yeah.
it's not even so much about the answers that contemporary Jews come to, because there is, you know, several thousand years of ongoing conversation about Jewish yeah. practice between Leviticus and now. And so those streams of conversation land in different places, but that core sort of the kernel from which all of that grows is that text. It was last week's portion, it's Mishpatim, it's in Exodus.
Yes, yeah.
It's in Mishpatim, it's in Exodus. And so that kernel
yeah.
right underlines all the conversations.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah. That yes. That there is and that there is a and I would say that is true for the strong majority mm-hmm. of the Jewish community in America and yeah. maybe the world. Although I have Orthodox clergy yeah. colleagues, like, you know, so Jewish sort of Orthodox to Reform doesn't always break down neatly yeah. Our long sort of mm-hmm. like political yeah. ideological streams. This doesn't always match up, but that sort of there, I think, are some Jews, partly because of the sort of the conflation of like conservative politics and anti-abort, you know, kind of the way that sort of all comes together. And yeah. so there are some Jewish communities where that kind of has become part of their Jewish practice. But yeah. like I was thinking, I mean, the National Council of Jewish Women, which is this yeah. more than 100-year-old Jewish yeah. organization that has, you know, fought for all kinds of different things. And this was their campaign around that. When I wrote the op-ed, it was part yeah. of this national campaign. We had a Shabbat, part of our Shabbat programming was around abortion rights and reproductive justice, and it was nationally around the country. There were different communities doing things around this, and there were communities from pretty much every single stream of Judaism engaged in this. Like abortion
yeah.
is not a yeah. We are, the conversation is about weighing the kind of the, you know, life and health and well-being of the person who's pregnant, and, you know, the potential life that is inherent in the fetus. And, you know, there's some pretty strong voices in the Talmud, for example, which say, well, like, basically that the pregnant person, sort of their well-being is paramount, like until the moment of birth.
I see.
And that, you know, I think that's one, you know, I think there are positions, you know, that people live in today that are like, there's a range of positions, but like that, you know, that for most Jews, the life of it.
I see. Okay. I never really, from the research I had done, it was really, I really appreciate how you kind of better defined kind of how that belief, that belief of the kind of the paramounts, as you said.
So it is in it's the first Torah portion after the revelation on Sinai. So basically up until then in the book of Exodus, we've had narrative, right? We've had this sort of sweeping story of slavery in Egypt and then, you know, plagues and the Red Sea and kind of, you know, figuring out life and then this revelation and Mount Sinai and whoa, like kaboom, right? Amazingness. And then we have, Mishpatim, which literally means laws. Right. It means, or, you know, it means, and so it, we go from this sort of story to like a set of rules. And so the way I like to think about this 12th portion is it's like, this is the first draft of how we're going to live in community as a free people. Right. This is the first draft of that. So it's got laws about free, you know, how, you know, slavery. It's got laws about manslaughter. Okay, right. So here is the actual text, right? When men fight, when men fight, and one of them winds up like pushing or shoving a woman who's pregnant and she loses, like, and there's a miscarriage. But there's no other damage, right? Like, so she is physically fine, but there is a miscarriage. So the one who pushed her, I'm just translating because I don't always trust the like, right? So the one who pushed her will surely be punished or fined according to the payment that her husband demands, right? So again, patriarchal society, like there's this issues of property, right? So it, you know, and so women are, if not, like not owned by their husbands, but they're sort of their husbands in most cases wind up acting for them in legal context. And in this case, particularly like this is like the loss of this fetus was like, you know, the husband can claim financial damages for this loss, basically. So this is assuming that nothing else happened to the pregnant woman, right? But if she is hurt if she is physically hurt, right? Something happens, then we have this line of like the penalty shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Like this is the eye for an eye piece,
yeah.
Which in Jewish law has never, I mean, like it was all like the rabbis understood it to be financial compensation, right? It wasn't, like no one was ever actually, we were not plucking at people's eyes. This is the, or at least rabbinically we weren't.
Yeah.
And the distinction there is, like, is separating out this fine, like the fetus is separated out, right? It's a different, this is coming in this series of sort of descriptions of what happens to sort of mm-hmm. accidental, like, what to do if you intentionally murder someone, what to do with manslaughter, what to do, in like issues around the death penalty, issues around what to do if you kill a slave, you know, a servant, a slave or servant in a household, right? Like all these things. Mm-hmm. And so, which means that this distinction with the fetus, mm-hmm. it becomes really clear in context that the fetus is different, you treat it differently than you treat manslaughter. Right, a miscarriage, even like a forced miscarriage, is in a whole different category. It's not equivalent to taking of a life of someone, of a breathing person.
Okay, well, thank you. That was very. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that.
Yeah, of course.
Because in your article, you talked about that, but it might be nice if people maybe hadn't read mm-hmm. the article. For you at least, personally, is this passage because as a Reconstructionist. Reconstructionist,
mm-hmm.
you kind of take a more, and as you said before, kind of the past is a vote, but not a veto. Mm-hmm. How does this passage, like specifically, how does it specifically like resonate with you?
So there's two answers. I've got a very personal answer. And then there's like a more like academic one.
Yeah.
So the more academic one is that for Jews living today, our Judaism is rabbinic Judaism, which is the Judaism of the Talmud, and the evolutions from the Talmud. And later evolutions of Jewish law and practice in the medieval codes of Jewish law and, you know, into the modern world of, you know, people figuring out, you know, through Jewish law and, how to live and, you know, how to live according to these practices in Jewish, in the modern world. So it is, when I read the Torah, and especially the legal parts of it, I'm not always reading it to be like, oh, this is what I should do. Like, that's not where I go to figure out, what do I do now? This is, the Torah is not going to tell me necessarily, like, what does my practice look like now? It is, because what practice looks like now is really much more based on, like, the couple thousand years of conversations that have grown out of the Torah.
Yeah.
And that's one of, I think, like, Jews read Torah all the time and read the Bible all the time and we're invested in it as a text and we, you know, talk about it and argue with it and it's like, you know, we're always in it, but it is like, it's not necessarily the foundation of like our like legal and ethical code. So that's sort of one piece of it. So when I read this text, you know, for me, I'm really curious about the woman's experience, right? I really want to know more about, like, who are these men? You know, who are these men? How did she get in the middle? Like, what's going on in this story? And I am really interested in the idea that, like, that in the ancient Near East, like, how were people thinking about and experiencing pregnancy? How are they, and child loss and how were, and pregnancy loss? Like, how was that? What was that experience? And was it really common? Was it uncommon? Were like enough women getting shoved by random men having a fist fight that like this needed to be encoded in law? Or is this here because to demonstrate something about, how we think about sort of this potential life, right? And differently than bachelor life. So like, those are the questions I'm asking. Like, I want to know more about what is under and within this story. So that's like really, what I think about. And then, you know, the really personal piece is that for me, like, you know, I've always been like pro-choice. Like, I've always been like, that's just, I never had to think about too much. It just always seemed really obvious to me that growing up, that was just, it just made sense, right? That like, you know, bodily autonomy that we have, you know, and when I had close friends who were pregnant, and even more so when my partner was pregnant, it became extra clear to me, right? Like that sense like became much more visceral and much more like not just an actual idea, but like, oh no, like this is vital that like that people should be able to like exercise this sort of autonomy, authority over their own bodies and not have to like donate, you know, their womb for 9 months if they don't want to. But even more than that, that like pregnancy is so dangerous. Like even today, right? Even in, you know, the year 2021, the experience of being pregnant is so painful and uncomfortable and, you know, like all kinds of things like, not even that things go wrong. It just put the part, you know, experience of being pregnant as it goes on is not always or often not like good for the health of the pregnant person. And like, I love babies and like, I love, you know, people. And like, I think, you know, I love my daughter and I love babies and I am, and it's like, but the idea that the state, I guess, right, should be imposing upon someone to like to take that risk of their own lives, of their own life, or their and their own physical being. And like almost all the people I know who have been pregnant have some degree of lasting physical change in their bodies, like, you know, and whether, you know, ranging from you know, there's just all kinds of different things that are still lying. So for me, like that, this text that, like the text in the Torah, the Exodus text, and then the ways that Jewish law evolved to really say, like, the life, and some Jewish, and some scholars, even up until like the 1970s, Orthodox Jewish scholars would say, no, the life and the well-being, like mental, spiritual, you know, physical, emotional, like all, like, of the pregnant person takes precedence over the life of the fetus. To me, that is like a really, like, I'm proud of that in Judaism, that way of like really respecting and honoring like the risk and the work of pregnancy. And I find that to be really powerful.
And wow, let me see here. I was also hoping, and I don't know how much more time you have, but mm-hmm. kind of the other part I was hoping, and this is probably the last thing I'll want to explore, is mm-hmm. you talk about the law, the, I believe it's referred to as a heartbeat bill that was passed in Ohio mm-hmm. By Governor DeWine, or that was signed mm-hmm. into law by. And I was wondering mm-hmm. if you talked about an article, but could you just maybe briefly explain what that law, what that says, and how that restricts mm-hmm. abortion?
Right. So it it's not, I have to preface it by saying it's not in effect now, that there was a stay put on it by federal courts. Yeah. By a federal court. But that law and others like it that are in other states that have similarly been stayed, it's sort of that, like, they're sort of all waiting, I think, to go into action should the Supreme Court undo Roe versus Wade, right? That's sort of the, like, they're all, those laws are all sort of there waiting so that when, if there is no longer like a federal mandate around abortion rights or access to abortion, then each state will be able to like have those laws be in place. So it's not in place now, but the you know, it's there waiting. Yeah. And my understanding of what the law does is it basically says after a heartbeat is detected, it prohibits abortion. And I have to go and look and see what the exceptions are, if there are any. But the sort of basic assumption is that once a heartbeat's detected, by, you know, in a, at that point in a fetus, it's no longer viable. And like, having gone, you know, having a child who's, you know, development, you know, but, you know, having experienced this, like, if not from within, then like very, very close, like, you know, I remember the first, that doctor visit where we went to like, you know, the heartbeat, and it is like a blinking dot, right? There's like nothing it's not a person yet. Like, there's not, you know, and like, as exciting and as moving as that moment was for us, like, that is not, it's not yet a person. And so what the heart people would do is say, like, it sort of enshrines this idea. I mean, partly I think because, you know, most pregnancies are, it's hard to specifically date conception, with the exception actually of queer people, and people who are struggling with infertility, then it's much easier to target, because you only did the one time, or you only, but it, so for me, that what that law does then is it, you know, absolutely undermines any ability that I would have as a rabbi counseling someone coming to me who's pregnant, or any Jewish person, Jewish doctor, you know, any Jewish person trying to sort of live into this idea of how we are supposed to understand, you know, the priorities here, right? It totally undermines our ability to do that, because it's now been, we now have this very set thing that, no, like, past 6 weeks, right? And most people who are pregnant, like, unless you are planning to get pregnant and like waiting with bated breath to, you know, to pee on the stick and do the thing, like, you might not know until 8 weeks. You might not even think to check until 8 weeks. You might not even, like, you know, it is this, that chunk of the first trimester where, like, you might not know. So it's basically saying that, like, any, you know, if there's like, if you get pregnant unintentionally and aren't tracking religions really closely, and they're like, oh, and you sort of are pregnant, and you're like, oh, now it's too late. I don't even have access to that choice anymore. So
kind of just around the issue of abortion and also the argument you lay out in the article, which is one of, it's a First Amendment argument, which is that it violates religious freedom, is how do you kind of decide if someone's, like, in terms of a policy level, how do you kind of incorporate, and how do you see there as being a space for religious belief in politics? Because on the one hand, you can use religion as, I think, as a way of a very powerful way, a force for good. But on the other hand, you can have, people can have certain religious beliefs that maybe, like someone could have a religious belief that, certain religions maybe have values that are not considered, you know, that maybe aren't part of, maybe that aren't quote unquote lawful, or that don't fit into the conception of what, of law, right? And then how do you decide kind of which belief systems and how they influence politics? Because I see it as almost like a double-edged sword, right? When it comes to how religion influences, I should be more succinct, not just politics, but lawmaking in general.
Yeah. So it's a good question. I would say that part of why I wanted to frame my op-ed in the context of a First Amendment argument, a freedom of religion argument, is because, especially around sort of, I don't know what to call them, but like issues like abortion, like same-sex marriage, the issues that are sort of these like hot button, I don't know, social issues that are very vital, that the default framing in society and in law is a pretty Christian one. And so is a pretty Christian one. And so I think if we are going to say that we are a country that offers, you know, that in which, you know, Congress shall make no law respecting freedom of religion or inhibiting the free exercise thereof, I think I got the quote wrong, but that's mostly what it means, right? Then that, to be taken seriously, you have to like examine the places where law is being based on this Christian foundation in an unexamined way.
Wow. Well, that was really eye-opening for me.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Yeah,
I think it's really good because I think more people just need to be aware of, the work you're doing, and also just how, just realize how multi, how it's, how issues like abortion get oversimplified a ton to like just, like religious versus like non-religious, whatever. And it's like, you're showing that it's way more multifaceted than that. I really appreciate you taking the time.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure. It was nice to meet you. And I'm glad you got hooked into the review, so you have a place that feels like yours and on campus, you know, in the Oberlin world. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And I cannot thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for
taking. You're really welcome. You're so welcome. It was really fun.
Yes, it was meaningful for me too. So take care.
All right. Bye.
Goodbye.
You're listening to WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. This has been The Weekly. All previously aired episodes of The Weekly are publicly available online. You can listen to them at anchor.fm/The Weekly.